The Guardian.
There's the one that looks like a flying duck, the one that smells like roadkill, the one that looks like a totally different species under UV light, and the one that's 2 millimetres across. The orchid family is one of the biggest and most diverse plant families on the planet. This week, we're going to be looking at orchids in all their wonderful glory. And we're going to start by heading down to Kew Gardens. If you want to see an orchid display to dazzle the senses, this is the place to be this month, as its annual orchid show showcases these flowers in all their glory. I'm off there now for a guided tour with Kew Gardeners, Elisa Biondi and Nick Johnson.
So this is, we're doing a Brazilian theme this year. In conjunction with the Olympics happening in Brazil, we thought we would celebrate all things Brazilian. So we've got these wonderful figures in the pond that look like carnival dancers. They'll be decked out like you'd go to a carnival in Rio and you'd see these beautiful dancers, except the difference with our carnival dancers is that they are made almost entirely from orchids and bromeliads, and even the feathers are made from plant material. But if we look at this pond display, what we've got in here is there's a very nice little orchid in amongst all of the other ones, which is this yellow Oncidium. Their common name is the Dancing Lady. And we found through studies that if you shine UV light onto one of the species of Oncidium, you'll see that they look exactly like a Malpighia flower. Malpighia is a tree from Central and Southern America. So insects see in a much wider spectrum than we do. And when they're seeing these plants with the UV light reflected off them, they're actually seeing something that they would normally pollinate. So they're being fooled into coming to these Oncidiums and pollinating them. They're not actually pollinating the right plant.
They're real tricksters, orchids, aren't they? There are so many different tricks that they employ. And I think that's what makes them extra fascinating. Mm.
Many orchids, in particular, the ones that we use in the festival, are what's called epiphytes. So they live up in trees. They don't parasitize trees. They literally just live on the wood, and they coexist with the trees. Also, the fungi in the forest as well. We found that many orchids have a symbiotic relationship with fungal partners, that they use to create almost a network of feeding roots all the way through where they're growing.
Fantastic. Shall we move? Let's go this way.
Orchids have modified roots. They have this covering over the top of the root, which is called velamen. And velamen is, in other plants, is their adaptation to take moisture from the air. But in orchids, there's a very special ingredient amongst the velamen, which is chlorophyll. Orchid roots can photosynthesize just as well as the leaves, so they've kind of used as much of the plant as they can to be able to photosynthesize and take energy from the sun.
And is that why when you buy an orchid in a garden center, they often come in a clear pot because taking advantage of the photosynthesis? Does it matter if you put them in a solid pot that the light can't get through? Should I be panicking about this?
Once you put them into a solid pot, you'll find that all of the roots, the subsequent roots that grow, will start bursting out of the sides of the pots. And that is, they're just looking for light. The clear pots that were developed by the Dutch for Phalaenopsis, the moth orchid, which you find in the shops and everything, are the best way to keep an orchid, so that you can get light to the roots. Main growers of Phalaenopsis, or the breeders of Phalaenopsis, usually you find them in Taiwan. It's a real kind of hobby thing in Taiwan to breed Phalaenopsis. But the other ones, those are, what they are, Cambrias, are they?
Yeah, it's like a man-made genus called Cambria, but it's so they're mainly South American, American, and Odontoglossum, they've got a different name, but they actually come from natural genera such as Oncidium, and they're basically just modified to create special looking hybrids. Mm. We also have got some Zygopetalum, which is the little purple orchids here.
Oh yes,
and
that, yeah.
This is a hybrid, but Zygopetalum is actually a natural genus.
And we talked about colour. Are there any colours that have yet to be achieved in orchids, or has every single colour been mastered by the breeders?
Actually, when I went to a Phalaenopsis nursery, because we every year we go and we hunt down all of these nurseries and find the plants, and we went to a Phalaenopsis nursery in Holland. Huge. They produce 1.5 million orchids for the UK market alone. And I asked the owner, he'd been growing Phalaenopsis for about 30 years, I said, what would be your ultimate colour? And he said, a blue Phalaenopsis. If I find anyone breeding a blue Phalaenopsis, then I can retire. So I was in the shops the other day and I actually saw a blue Phalaenopsis, and for a minute I was taken aback and I went and had a look at it, and then I realised that they're actually dyed. They're someone's dying flowers.
Wow.
So anyway, yes, blue Phalaenopsis, naturally bred blue Phalaenopsis, would be the holy grail for a lot of orchid producers.
Are there any edible that comes off orchids?
Yeah, vanilla. Vanilla planifolia
is
the seed pod. And if you open up a seed pod and you see that kind of pasty looking stuff, that's actually millions and millions of tiny dust-like seed that when conglomerated together look almost like a paste. But that's actually orchid seed that we're eating as a vanilla flavour.
So if I take my vanilla bean, cut it open and take those seeds, is there any chance on this planet that I'm going to be able to germinate some vanilla bean orchids? Or am I doomed to failure?
I think you're probably doomed to failure.
Damn, okay. And is that a beautiful orchid, or is it?
It's a liana type orchid. It climbs and spreads by lianas through the trees. It comes from South America originally as well. But our main producer is actually the Madagascans. They've cracked how to grow and produce vanilla. And many years ago, I visited a vanilla farm in Madagascar. Because they don't have the natural pollinator of vanilla in Madagascar, because it's obviously being exported to this new country, they have to hand pollinate every single flower in order to ensure a pod grows. Pollinating an orchid is quite complex, because each orchid is adapted for pollination by a specific pollinator. So a lot of them use toothpicks to flip open a little lid inside the flower and then transfer the pollinia from one area into another to ensure pollination.
So this explains why vanilla beans aren't cheap, really, and why they shouldn't be cheap, because there's a lot of work going into that by the sound
absolutely,
of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. The most common varieties of orchids that we get in the shops are mainly Phalaenopsis, and they're all produced almost on a factory line nowadays. But that's not to say that there is a huge trade in endangered and illegal trade in orchids, and these are mainly a trade of things that collectors are after, just to complete a collection of plants. And there are examples of orchids that have been discovered, and then when they've gone back to survey them a few years later, every single one is gone because of over-collection.
So is that a bit of a challenge for you, given that you want to promote orchids as a wonderful thing, but at the same time there's always going to be a minority of people for whom it becomes an obsession to collect every single... Is there any answer other than education, I suppose?
Education is the only way. And we, at Kew, we do talk about that in the Orchid Festival, talking about illegal collection and poaching and things like that. So here we are in one of the two species zones. This one's temperate, so a lot cooler. And you can smell quite a lot of smells in here. It's very perfumed in here at the moment.
I don't think of orchids as being particularly scented, but obviously
it does depend a lot on what kind of pollinators they're attracting. And if you notice, in this case, the mainly perfumed ones are the ones that are white. Mm. So it's an extra way to attract the pollinators rather than have very strong colours.
You can see we're just starting to dress this tree here. This is actually a wholly rendered concrete tree. This was made by our students over the last couple of weeks. And it's going to be a new addition to this orchid zone, and hopefully it'll be here permanently. The reason we have to use rendered concrete trees to mount our orchids in here is because it's so humid, after a while the trees that we mount the orchids onto rot away and fall over, so you have to have something a little bit stronger to be able to take the strain.
You don't want a visitor to be taken out by a rotting tree.
No. These cases, by the way, these glass cases here, this is where we're going to be displaying our species orchids. And they're behind glass because some of them are very rare and very valuable.
Yeah, and here we've got, this is the tropical zone. So again, it's a little bit warmer than the one that we've just been. And here in front of us, there's an example of South American orchids, Lelia. In here we've got many interesting orchids, which unfortunately they do flower in other times of the year, so that's why we add extra either hybrids or some orchids from the nursery, which they come and you can see them in the cases.
These are slipper orchids or papiopedilums, and this one here, see, it's got kind of spotted all over the petals, and it has these weird kind of lumps all over it. This is egg mimicry or damage mimicry from aphids, because its pollinator is an aphid parasite, a parasitic wasp that just lays its eggs inside aphids. So that then shows the pollinator that, oh, there must be aphids there, and it'll come down and start doing its thing, but actually, unwittingly, it's pollinating the flower.
That's evolution at work. That's absolutely, what an amazing adaptation.
Yeah.
How on earth does that happen? It's just, it must blow your mind when you get, the further you get into knowing about these plants, the more fascinating they are. Mm. I mean, that's just completely blown my mind. That's really, really strange.
Yeah.
But wonderful that you can, that we can see that and we can understand what's going on behind that. Oh, look, it's a pretty orchid.
Yeah.
But also amazing if you think about Darwinism and evolution, how that has happened at random.
Yeah. I hope you've had your mind blown, audience. Thank you very much to Nick and Elisa.
What a stunner that show is, and it's lovely and toasty in the glasshouse too, perfect for a winter garden trip. The Kew Orchid Show is on until March the 6th. For opening times and more details, visit kew.org. And now I'm joined in the studio by Suzanne Masters, who's a plant scientist doing a PhD studying wild orchids in Turkey, and she's been wild orchid hunting from English seashores to the Bhutanese mountains. Let's start by clearing up any confusion about the name of the orchid.
So the name of orchids actually comes from the kind of orchids that were around Europe when the ancient Greeks started looking at things and giving them names. So when they saw these plants that had two tubers that were more or less spherical, they named them after the Greek word orchis, which means testicle.
So
that's where the name orchid comes from. But since then, we've gone on to name lots more species of orchids, and a lot of the tropical orchids don't have that form. And actually, people naming orchids still carry on giving them rather rude names.
What is it about these plant breeders? They always seem to come up with the most silly names for plants. Is it just, are they just having a joke on us, or what?
I think maybe there's some people, you know, you're stuck in the herbarium and then you get out, you find something exciting, and then you come back to, you know, you're back in the herbarium and give it a wild and exciting name that's a bit saucy. because it's funny, but it's in Latin, so it's
not that funny after all. And was there any kind of idea then that the significance of the double tuber looking like a testicle, did anyone then think, oh, this must be an aphrodisiac, or did anyone sort of make that connection?
Yes, they absolutely did. I would say that the double tuber, I've seen loads of orchid plants dug up in Turkey and on sale in the markets, and only once have I seen one where I thought, oh yeah,
I get it.
Most of the time there's one, because of the life cycle, you have one very fresh, you know, juicy looking tuber, and then you have another one that's a bit withered and shriveled because that's the old one. So it most of the time it looks okay. Not really like orchis.
Okay, well, I'm glad that we've cleared that up from the start. Now, we mentioned the orchids in the market. So orchids as a foodstuff, that's something that hadn't occurred to me before.
Yes. Well, orchids are really, they're the biggest plant family in the world, and they have huge distribution across, you know, all the continents, really, apart from the frozen ones. And wherever people are, they do make uses of plants. And the thing about orchids is there's only one that's really in big scale cultivation, which is vanilla. And there are actually lots of edible orchids, but they're quite difficult to cultivate. So this also has implications for conservation, because if you're going to eat something that can only really be harvested from the wild, that species can sometimes be threatened by that harvest.
Which is obviously a problem, and why we're concerned about rare orchids around the world. Now, you're obviously going out to Turkey and studying these flowers. One of the things that fascinates me is the way that they look like things that they're not.
Yes.
And this whole sense of, are they having a laugh here? How come they've evolved to look like a monkey? How can that be? How does that work? Are there lots of ones that mimic things? What's the pollination strategy, or is it very different from plant to plant?
Well, one of the reasons orchids have this incredible diversity is in terms of what we perceive when we look at them and we see their flowers, is flowering plants mostly need pollinators. Some of them will self-pollinate, but really the flower is a mechanism for attracting a pollinator. So in order to attract different pollinators, you can do different things. So if you're a bee orchid, you can be a little bit fuzzy, and people think, oh, this maybe resembles the fuzziness of something like a bumblebee, or you can release strange scents that will attract predatory wasps, because the wasp thinks there's a little caterpillar on your leaf, so you give out the smell of a leaf that's being eaten, and then you entrap your pollinator like that. So, you know, these massive sort of pouches and petals and scents that range from really divine to really stinky, these are actually attractive to pollinators. And so that's sort of the old thing that's shaped their forms. But now, with developments in technology and horticulture, you get one plant that looks a bit different, and you cross it with another plant, and you can create something new. And, you know, it's desirable to have really big blooms or blooms in a certain colour. So we're actually now at the stage where you can get genetically modified orchids, which is the blue Phalaenopsis that was introduced a couple of years ago. I think they're not in mainstream sale yet.
Going on to the subject of going and buying orchids, perhaps the more cheaper end of the market, the moth orchid, which you see in every supermarket now, do you feel a bit sad when you see them all crammed onto the shelf in their little plastic sheaths? Or do you kind of ever go and see a really sad looking one and think, I've got to free this plant and buy it just because you can't stand it? Or are you glad to see that they're so widespread?
I think it's great for people to have plants in their homes, which actually in Phalaenopsis, yesterday someone said to me, if I was going to grow a plant that would flower pretty much most of the time indoors, what would it be? And I thought, well, actually, Phalaenopsis, a happy Phalaenopsis, can really be flowering for most of the year because the blooms last so long, and if it's happy, as soon as one flower spike's finished, you've got a new one coming up. If you get them in the right light level, you don't water them too much, They love household temperatures.
You're killing me here, because you know what? I am rubbish. Admission time, I am rubbish at growing Phalaenopsis. And I do have quite a few houseplants of other kinds, some of which are quite difficult to grow. I'm, you know, proud to say, but I just can't get I mean, I can get them to the stage of like they'll be flowering happily, then they get to the end of that flower stalk and then something happens and I never see any more flowers, and eventually I have a wizened thing, and I think, oh gosh, all goes the other way, and it's, you know, I rarely overwater, but then sometimes, you know, that happens. So it's always sad. And I'm at the moment feeling very conscious that I have a dendrobium orchid, which was given to me at Christmas time, which at the moment is flowering nicely. But again, I'm in fear that I'm going to kill it. So, I mean, is there a foolproof technique for getting them to reflower?
So there is a foolproof technique for each different one, but you have to check what light levels they need, and you need to check the temperatures. So some of them, like a Phalaenopsis, 16 degrees centigrade, sort of household temperature, that's perfect. They like bright light, but not direct light. So don't put them on a sunny windowsill, but put them near a sunny windowsill. Whereas the Oncidiums, that used to be called Odontoglossum, they actually like nighttime temperatures to be colder than daytime temperatures. Don't let them get colder than 11 degrees, but also they don't want to be too hot because they're from the Andean cloud forest.
This is where it all goes pear-shaped, isn't it? They're really pushing their luck here.
Yes. And then you get another type of Oncidiums, which are the warm Oncidiums, and they don't really need a big temperature difference between day and night to flower, but they do like humidity, but they will be generous with their flowers. So it's really... And sometimes the care instructions on the labels of a plant actually aren't that helpful. So it's worth just checking either online, or you could join your local orchid society. There are lots of them everywhere, and you'll meet very friendly people who will give you a lot of advice.
And I find there's usually somebody in my family who doesn't claim any green-fingered credentials, who's just amazed that you go around the house and you're like, oh, there's orchids everywhere, they're all flowering, and then I just feel a total failure. There's always somebody in the family or among your family or friends who will be just somehow magically good at this. Perhaps it's just they've got the right windowsill or right setting.
The right water, because actually most of the orchids you're growing within a household, they don't like alkaline water or hard water or water that's really heavily chlorinated. They're epiphytes, so what they like is a bit of rainwater.
See, that could be where I'm going wrong.
And don't get rainwater out of an icy rainwater barrel. You get the rainwater and bring it indoors and let it come to room temperature before you dump it on them.
And it's worth also noting that there's a sort of there seems to be in the plant catalogues of recent, last couple of years, actually I'm starting to see outside orchids being offered for sale. Can you tell me a bit about these outdoor orchids that we can grow?
There are hardy orchids that can survive a frost outdoors. And actually at the Chelsea Flower Show in Dan Pearson's garden, the Laurent Perrier Chatsworth garden, he had some marsh orchids. I think they were wide-leaved marsh orchids, Dactylorhiza majoralis. And they were there, planted out in Chelsea. There was a bee orchids in the little Old Forge garden, and Jacques Armand had a huge selection of hardy orchids, including I think even one of the English natives. On the way here I bumped into someone who I know, and every now and then I go around his mum's garden in Bishop Stortford, and it's a very little garden, it's a very little lawn, and next to the medlar tree they've got this beautiful ever-increasing patch of common spotted orchids that are actually almost crowding out the grass. And it started just with one, and then that one was happy, and it's obviously reproducing and spreading across the lawn. But there's other ones as well. Bee orchids will often pop up in a lawn. And when orchids start flowering and performing in a lawn, that's actually quite in tune with more contemporary approach to lawns, which is not cutting them really short, just leave them that bit longer, and then seeds and spores that are actually in the soil get a chance to grow up, do their thing. So you can try letting your lawn just leave a patch, let it get quite long and knee high, and cut it, you know, the first cut after June. And also you can do scrapes, so clear just the top layer of grass in a patch. So you've got bare earth. And if you can source hay from a meadow near as near as possible to you, a meadow that has orchids in it, you'll get, and just lay the hay on that bare soil and leave that. That's one way to introduce really local plants into your lawn and see what comes up. Or you can actually buy things like common spotted orchids. I don't think I've seen bee orchids for sale, but common spotted orchids, some of the marsh orchids, like the one at Chatsworth, you can, in the Chatsworth garden, you can actually buy those, dig a hole, put it in your lawn, and then let it grow. And if it's happy, it will spread. But you'll need to match the conditions of your site to whichever orchid you select.
I can just see my neighbour's face when I start scraping bits off my lawn and laying hay on it. He's just, I think yet again, oh, she's gone nuts now. But I think that's an interesting way of doing it. Actually, as you say, if it's a local seed coming from plants that are adapted to that local environment, then you've got a good chance of success. So that's an interesting way of looking at it. And if all else fails, obviously, you can buy some, hopefully, from a responsibly sourced supplier.
Yes. There are certainly plenty of nurseries now that, because terrestrial orchid growing is a little bit more difficult because you're having to balance the soil and the way the plant survives. Whereas with the epiphytes, it's easier just sort of tying them to a piece of bark or a pot, and you can control conditions differently. There's a lot more species available for growing outdoors that are coming from nurseries, so it's really important to distinguish between plants that have been reared from seed by growers or something that's been dug up from the wild, probably won't survive being transplanted to your garden, and also means that you are participating in illegal wildlife trade.
So you need to be careful in your sourcing. Some dodgy guy down the pub is probably not your best source for a new orchid collection. And how easy are they to grow outside? Are they pretty much a doddle if you're careful, or am I going to buy an expensive orchid and then have depressing experience?
They're pretty much like most plants. Just put them in the right place and they're going to be happy. So a lot of the orchids, you've got to remember, are a bit slower growing. So if you plant them next to something huge that's going to crowd them out, they'll start to be unhappy. The terrestrial orchids, which is orchids that grow in the ground, they do have quite complex relationships with fungi, and that's one of the reasons why you can't just dig one up from the wild and move it to your garden. But for most situations in a garden, there are orchids that will work. I think probably the most thuggish one that should do well in most situations and please you with lots of flowers is Platylus striata, which is, I think it's called the hyacinth orchid. It's Asian, and it's actually used in Chinese medicine, and there's a lot of trade in it as a medicinal plant, and it's grown in southern China for that trade in huge amounts. But that one's probably, you know, a nice thuggish plant that will make a little ground cover with its leaves, and it'll stand up to the other plants.
I like the sound of a thug. That's good.
Yeah.
A thuggish orchid. I never thought that would be a combination that you'd get, but that sounds great.
Yes. And then, actually, last spring, I did see at both Wisley and Kew, they do have orchids in their alpine sections. So they're Cypripedium calcealis, the slipper orchids. And these have now been bred, so you can actually get them in different colour variations. Again, this is coming out of nurseries, mostly from Holland the stock is coming, so these are not wild collected, which is obviously, you know, nearly brought the slipper orchid to extinction in England. So they work well. And then there's some interesting things like even some Australian orchids, Pterostylis culter, the blunt green hood orchid from Australia, that was popping up in Kew and Wisley as a little plant in the alpine section. And the thing about alpines is you're not letting alpines sit in with wet roots over winter, and actually that works quite well for a lot of orchids because they can tolerate cool or even freezing temperatures, but not when they're soggy and wet.
Well, I hope that's inspired a few of you to try either saving a moth orchid from instant destruction at the supermarket shelf, or perhaps going for one of these hardy jobs, which sound fantastic. What I need to know is, will they survive a lurcher? Will my dog knock them all down? That's probably my major concern right now, but I'm prepared to give them a go. I like the sound of the thug. Suzanne Masters, thank you very much. That's all for this week. Please feel free to share your orchid successes and failures with us. You can tweet us at Guardian Gardens, join our Guardian Gardening Facebook page, or get in touch via email, gardens@theguardian.com. We'd love to hear from you. Bye!
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.